You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Governor Walker says a contested GOP convention could lead to a presidential nominee who's not currently in the race. First, we're talking about something you might not want to admit that you do at work.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Well, crying at work can be a touchy subject. If you do it, you might do it privately and without telling anyone. A couple years ago, the Huffington Post interviewed high-profile women about crying at work, and the majority of them said it was a bad thing to do or gave a negative view on crying in the workplace. In fact, the CEO of the Girl Scouts, Frances Hesselbein, said, quote, "Tears belong within the family." In the past year, 41% of women have cried at work, according to a survey. Only 9% of men said they did. Our next guest makes the case that looking down on crying at work is sexist. She says it should be okay to cry at work. And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Have you ever cried at work? What were the circumstances? And how did your colleagues respond? Do you think people changed their opinions about you because you cried? And was it for better or for worse? Do you think it's sexist to look down on crying in the workplace? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your story on the Central Time Facebook page. Olga Kazan joins us now. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we mentioned a survey showing women crying more than men at work. Why is that?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is, I guess, some of them are kind of just biological. So women produce more of this hormone called prolactin, which seems to promote crying, and also testosterone suppresses it, and men have more testosterone. And then another kind of strange, weird thing is that men have larger tear ducts than women, so more of their tears can kind of well up in their eyes before they actually spill out onto their cheeks.
And so those are both biological reasons, but I'm guessing a big part of it is social. What are some of the social dynamics that are at play?
Sure. Well, we shouldn't underestimate that, you know, men are socialized from a young age not to cry. But it's largely because it is associated with women and femininity. And then also people kind of, usually when people are crying, especially at work, it's not because they're just sad and despondent. It's because they're kind of sort of experiencing this sort of helpless anger. And for whatever reason, women, when they encounter, you know, frustrating situations, they experience this kind of helpless or hopeless anger. And that's according to one researcher that I talked to. But also, you know, when men feel angry, they can kind of explode and pound on things and swear. But women can't really do that, or at least they're penalized for doing that, you know, to the same degree that men are. So their kind of best option is to cry sometimes.
So it sounds like you're saying that the reasons that we cry outside of work, like maybe at home because there's been a loss in the family or a fight with a spouse or something like that, the things that trigger tears at work are a little different, that it's almost more of a stress response, it sounds like.
Well, actually, it's interesting. So a lot of people do cry during sad situations, like the loss of a loved one. But the most common thing that makes people cry at any time at work or at home is sort of a frustrating situation. So the fight with a spouse is not sad per se, right? It's frustrating.
So why did you decide to write about this issue of crying at work and whether it's okay or not, or whether it should be okay?
I don't know. It's just something that I've like thought about. I've cried at work, and so I clearly, you know, have a stake in, I guess. And then, you know, I know my colleagues who have, and I just thought it would be an interesting thing to explore. Plus, there are all these gender differences. So, anytime you have that, you have like an interesting wrinkle of society to explore.
So, you interviewed one of your female colleagues, and here's what she had to say about why she cries at work.
For me, it's always a combination of being tired, being stressed, sort of getting in a mentality where I'm already feeling sorry for myself, and then in some way that becomes reinforced, and then I just get into a very woe is me frame of mind and then start crying.
And so in talking with her, did what she said causes her to cry ring true with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was kind of surprising for me was actually that everyone that I talked to, you know, I for the video, I mostly talked to my colleagues, seemed to have a different reason for crying at work. So some people, it wasn't anything about their job per se. Some people, it was, you know, kind of feeling sorry for themselves because of all the stress. You know, for others, it was just like they felt like their, you know, manager or whoever wasn't hearing them well and, you know, or understanding them. So they got frustrated with the situation. You know, so it was just sort of interesting to hear all the different reasons why people cried. So I feel like there's no hard and fast rule there.
Well, Susan from Cedarburg is on the line. So let's go to the phones. Susan, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I had an experience where working, I would get frustrated, perhaps a little bit angry with my interactions with people and feeling like I needed to cry as a release for my emotions, but I would never do it with other people seeing me just because I think that would be judged very poorly. But I would go into the woman's bathroom and release, you know, just cry and let myself kind of release those emotions. And what I found was it really helped me to get over those that feeling quicker than had I tried to keep suppressing it and dealing with it in amongst other people. And so I was then able to go back to, you know, back to my desk and face that situation in a little bit better mindset, I felt.
And Susan, when you said that you didn't want to do it in public in front of your coworkers, did you have more concern about crying in front of male or female coworkers, or did it have the same kind of level of risk to you?
Same level. To me, it didn't matter. It's just something you don't do in the workplace. Earlier in my career, I worked predominantly with men, so maybe that's why I think that. And in fact, I once had a manager tell me that I was too emotional, even though I never cried or did what I considered emotional activities in the workplace. But yes, as someone just said, I think men are viewed upon differently. If a man gets very emotional and angry and raises his voice, it's okay. And a woman's not allowed to do that.
Well, thanks for the call, Susan. And Olga Kazan, what would you say to Susan?
I think that's a great, you know, striking a nice balance. You know, if you feel like you need to get those emotions out, you know, because you're getting frustrated, but you know, aren't someone who's comfortable with your colleagues seeing you cry, maybe it would, you know, be a good solution to go to the bathroom and sort of cry privately. A lot of people are bathroom criers, I think, for that reason. So, yeah, I think that's a good solution for people who feel that way.
We're talking with Olga Kazan about her recent article for The Atlantic about crying at work. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And one thing that Susan said was that crying helped, getting it out helped, and you really echoed that, Olga. Sometimes people will refer to crying at work as letting your emotions get the best of you. Do you think that's true?
Well, I definitely don't think it's true that crying means you're letting your emotions get the best of you. But I'm also not sure what that means. I mean, people are emotional. and, you know, we have emotions wherever we go. We have positive emotions. We have negative emotions. I think crying might be better than some of the other negative emotions you might feel, like the desire to undermine someone or to gossip about someone. You know, so in that sense, I think crying is probably preferable. But, you know, my manager is actually in this video, and he was talking about how, like, well, you know, why wouldn't people cry at work? Because, like, all your emotions happen at work. So, yeah, I guess I don't really think that.
So you did talk to female colleagues, but you also talked to male colleagues. And this is what one of your male colleagues had to say about crying at work.
If I'm crying at work and it's like an uncontrollable situation, like, I don't want it to be happening. I'll always be like trying to like make myself.
So, Olga, what do you hear from men who feel the need to cry but don't really feel like they should be giving up that power?
Well, I talked to two of my, as far as like, I talked to two of my male managers and then two male coworkers, and neither of the male coworkers had cried because of of like work related problems. They had both cried because of kind of either personal issues or just like things that were making them emotional at work. One of them has like a very emotional beat, so I think it like was hard for him sometimes to just like listen to his interviews. And one of them, like, you know, really, he cried at work once and he felt really embarrassed about it. You know, but everyone else seemed really kind of like accepting of it and really, you know, consoled him and everything. And the other one said that he tries not to cry at work, but it still happens sometimes and he just sort of hides behind his computer. I thought, but they did sort of make it sound like they really tried not to do it. And actually the women did too. The women were saying that they would do anything to not be crying. But it seemed like they didn't feel like it was as maybe as bad, you know, like the men really seemed to think that like you should be stoic at work. You shouldn't be crying, you know.
We're talking with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic now about crying from work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever seen one of your colleagues cry at work? And did it change your opinion of them? How did you react? And if you've ever cried at work, what prompted you to feel the need to cry? And how did people take it? Do you think it should be okay to cry in the workplace? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation now with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic about crying at work. And Olga, we have some callers on the line, so let's go to the phones. Evelyn in Kenosha is up first. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share my, you know, experience with crying at work. I started my career quite early on, and I worked in a professional setting, you know, in my early 20s. And I believe when I first started out, if things at work were, you know, it got to me, or if I found something frustrating, I would be more emotional. And I have had instances at work where I cried, or I got overly emotional at the verge of crying, where I would fight tears till I like try to get to a place where I could be by myself. But I feel like as I got older, I've learned to channel that differently. So rather, yes, you know, things will happen at work where you get frustrated, but rather than crying or rather than being emotional, I try to compartmentalize it and try to deal with it in a different way. And one of the reasons I did that is because I believe crying at work does affect you and how others view you. And I feel like you're viewed weak or overly emotional, and it might stand in your way to leadership positions, especially as a woman, because, I mean, I've only seen women cry. And I have never actually, to date, worked with somebody who's a man who's cried. And I feel like the perception of women crying at work makes them look weak and less of a leadership candidate.
Well, thanks for those comments, Evelyn. And Olga, I'm guessing that you might say that's part of the reason why we need to look at why there's this taboo and whether it is based in sexist attitudes.
Yeah, I mean, she's absolutely right. Women are judged harshly for crying at work. They're in several studies, or in one study that was specifically workplace-based, the sort of, you know, it was sort of like negative to cry in a performance review or basically like any kind of work setting, but to cry about like a personal tragedy was like sometimes acceptable. But, you know, it was sort of like, For the women, they were viewed as emotional and lacking in control, while the men, were kind of humanized by crying. It is definitely quite sexist, and it can hold you back at work. That's why I think people should stop judging work criers.
Let's go back to the phones, and Deborah in Brown Deer is up next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Well, I'm not a bathroom crier. I just want to establish that. But I think crying is like laughing. It's something you just have to do. It's a bodily function, and I've seen men in the past month or two, like three political leaders crying, or almost like tears welled up in President Obama's eyes when he was referring to his daughters. I watched the Nancy Reagan's funeral, and of course, I guess it's okay for men to cry and women at a funeral, but I don't know. I feel like it's such a normal function. I don't know, understand what the problem is, and I think it's really when you're sincerely crying, it just you can't help it. It just comes out.
Well, thanks for that comment, Deborah. Olga?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. And actually, it's really common. 41% of women, according to this one study, admitted to crying at work. That's those who admitted to doing it. So the real number is probably actually higher. And 9% of men, for some of the reasons that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So when you have 40% of the population doing something, I don't think it's like this terrible taboo thing anymore. Like it's, you know, it's just a normal human part of life.
It does get very interesting with men. And let's hear what one of your male colleagues had to say about crying at work.
I feel like you have to be stoic at work. I do cry. It's just like going to a conference room and closing the door.
Why do you feel like you have to be stoic at work?
I don't know. I feel like there's a stigma attached to it. A coworker has seen me tear up while reading like a story, or maybe it was like a kitten video. And that was the thing that he mentioned for the rest of the months that we were coworkers.
So that's really interesting. So he feels like showing that emotion and in front of another man, really, he could never shake that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he sort of did live it down. Like, I think he's being a little bit facetious, maybe. But, you know, one of my male managers at the same time said that the stress of managing people, like, sometimes makes him cry, actually, in front of other people. So, you know, it really runs the gamut. Like, you can't, you know, it's different for everyone. So, you know, he told some really poignant stories about times when, you know, two of his direct reports wanted, you know, two totally different things, and he had to make a decision that would really impact both of their lives. And, you know, definitely the pressure of that can get to you.
Let's go back to the phones and Jan in Burlington. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to relay a story. I spent 39 years in corporate America, and during, you know, if you're in business for that long, you will go through downsizing, and those can be very gut-wrenching, emotional. You know, especially when people are escorted out of the building, they come into work one day, have no clue of what's going to happen. And we had what was literally a bloodbath like that one day. And I really respected a male coworker of mine who was also a manager. He called me aside and he said, "I never thought I'd cry at work. And I cried today."
Mm-hmm. So it feels like, even if men cry less, it doesn't mean that there aren't those times that they feel moved to. And Olga, how are men perceived when they cry at work?
So for the one study, there wasn't enough men actually who did so for her to find a significant difference. But just something that this researcher noticed was that the people had like universally better responses to the men crying. They said things like, "It made me feel closer to him," or "It humanized him." And then kind of out in the world, so not at work, men are perceived more positively than women when they cry. Specifically when they not full on cry, but sort of like tear up, mm-hmm. or look kind of misty eyed.
Get choked up maybe.
Yeah. So yeah, get choked up. Like that is like very, very, that's like the most positive possible outcome is to be a man who's like choked up.
Well, and as part of your research for this article, you actually talked to an actor to get some tips on how to prevent tears. And what advice did he have?
He sort of suggested sort of taking deep breaths and getting really grounded and putting both of your feet on the floor and sort of, I guess like trying to center yourself, which I think is good advice, except I feel like I would never remember to do that next time I felt like a cry coming on.
So people perceive crying at work differently based on gender, as we've been talking about. So what do you think needs to change, or can these really deeply ingrained prejudices or perceptions be changed to make it okay for anyone to cry at work?
I mean, look, it's, you know, this article is aspirational. I don't think it's, you know, legislation is not going to be passed saying you have to let people cry at work. I just hope that it's like a gradual social change. But I think, you know, you are seeing, another manager of mine that I talked to said, you know, when people cried in front of him, it used to make him really uncomfortable. But now he sort of just, you know, offers them a Kleenex and sort of waits it out, and it's sort of fine for him. I mean, maybe it's not totally fine, but he's a little bit more comfortable with it. You do see, like, even within individual people, them kind of changing how they view crying at work, and I think that's a good thing. I think people just shouldn't get so freaked out about it.
I think it's interesting, going back to those high-level female business leaders who are saying, you know, there's no room for crying at work, keep it at home, you know, do it off the clock, basically. It almost makes me wonder if, because they have probably had to leave behind some of their more female characteristics to rise to those levels, if maybe they've kind of adopted that male perception of crying and whether it's acceptable or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting you say that, because you do see that among women who get to be in really, you know, high leadership positions, is that a lot of times they do sort of try to blend in with the men and sort of just do whatever the men think should be done. So you do get that among women at high levels. But I think Sheryl Sandberg, actually, who's also obviously a very high-level woman, said that she has cried at work and she thinks it's fine. So even there you have sort of a range of attitudes. So it's all about just letting those more permissive or more accepting attitudes flourish.
And so just in the last couple of minutes that we have left, what would you suggest to people who see someone who might look like they're needing to cry but clearly don't feel comfortable? What would you, have you learned yourself, Olga, how to approach people who maybe feel this need at work and don't really feel comfortable?
I guess I would just say, you know, if I'm trying to have a meeting with them, I would say, you know, are you okay? Offer them a Kleenex, you know, if I have one, and then say, you know, do you want to take a break? Do you want to, you know, not have this conversation right now? But if they say no, it's okay, let's just keep going, which is what I've heard is usually what people say. Then I think you just kind of, you know, treat it like they're smiling or like they're, you know, laughing or whatever else people might mm-hmm. be doing with their face.
And maybe not trying to fix the situation in that moment, but just kind of being there for someone.
Yeah, you know, just sort of accept that that's just what they're going through.
Well, Olga, thanks so much for being with us. It was a really interesting conversation.
Good, I'm glad. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Olga Kazan, staff writer at The Atlantic. She was with us to talk about her recent piece about crying at work. You can get to that article on a link on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also keep the conversation going there with your thoughts about crying in the workplace. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then a look at Governor Walker's comments on a contested GOP convention and how it could lead to a presidential nominee who's not currently running. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickard.
It's time for Food Friday. Cookbooks can be a great resource and a great read, but what makes one really stand out from the rest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Tell us your favorite cookbook, maybe the one you always go back to. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She also writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section, and she writes for Edible Medicine and for Brava Magazine. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, in your opinion, what makes a great cookbook?
Well, first and foremost, well-tested recipes. Every once in a while, you bump into a cookbook that maybe didn't spend as much time testing its recipes as it should have, but when they work, they're great. I also love head notes with great stories, and wonderful photography is always a bonus too.
And is it how a cookbook is organized and laid out important for how useful it is?
You know, it is, but these days you see almost everything. You see some that are organized by season, others that are organized by, you know, what type of meal it is. So you really see everything, and especially since there's so many different types of cookbooks these days, ones that are, you know, span the gamut of everything and others that are focused on a single ingredient or a single type of food.
I definitely notice when there is not a good index in the back, because
I really like
to be able to go and see, well, I've got some corn. What do you got for corn? And if there's not a good index, I'm not too likely to use that.
Very true. That's extremely helpful.
Now, Anna, I'm kind of ruthlessly practical when it comes to cookbooks. I want to use them to cook things, but a lot of them are for reading, and they have stories and travel experiences and stuff like that. Is that fun? Do you enjoy that kind of backstory, a cookbook as literature?
I do. I read them as books. I sit down at night, I get a cup of tea or a cocktail, and I'll sit down and read them. I love it.
And looking at how a cookbook is organized or kind of the production value, how important do you think photos are in a cookbook?
You know, they're a definite bonus. I love to have them because visually I like to read the ingredients of a recipe and see a picture, and it helps me get an idea of what I'm about to embark on. But I'm not going to hold it against a cookbook. And a lot of cookbooks these days are doing really cool things with, you know, almost comic book graphics or illustrations. So there's lots of different designs.
We're talking about cookbooks. You can share your favorite cookbook, your go-to cookbook, at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Anna Thomas Bates at blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. And we'll go to a caller now with Marie in Genesee. Marie, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what's your cookbook, Marie?
It's called An Occasion to Gather, and it's from the Milwaukee Junior League.
And tell us about it. Why is this a good cookbook?
Every recipe that I have ever tried, it comes out perfect. And we were talking about pictures, and their graphics are beautiful, and you actually see what you're going to end up with.
Marie, thank you so much for sharing that one. And Anna, she said the recipes come out perfect. And I don't know, all cookbooks maybe aren't created equal. We've talked to people from America's Test Kitchen mm-hmm. about how they try to account for what the user might actually do with their recipe. Is there a big variety of outcome from one cookbook to another?
You know, there is, and since I write recipes myself in my cooking column, you have to write things very carefully and test them very carefully, but there's also a lot of differentiation in people's ovens and the weather and ingredients. So I spend a lot of time on email answering questions and helping people out, and sometimes it's just user error. They thought they were really doing it right, but, you know, there's just certain tweaks. But well-tested recipes are definitely a must, and America's Test Kitchen is always a classic go-to.
Let's go back to the phones, and Gigi in Madison is up next. Hi, Gigi.
Hi.
Hi. What's your favorite cookbook?
The A to Z Mac Sacks cookbook.
And what is that exactly?
Ben Hunter's Brussels sprouts.
Ah, and so is Ben Hunter's Brussels sprouts your favorite recipe in that book?
Yes, it is.
And what do you like about it? Because you sound like maybe you're a kid. How old are you, Gigi?
9 years old.
So I have to say, I'm guessing there are a lot of 9-year-olds who Brussels sprouts would not be their favorite recipe. What is it about Ben Hunter's Brussels sprouts that you love?
Well, I love the taste because you use apple cider vinegar. Ooh. And I, not apple cider vinegar, apple cider for it. And it just has this really sharp flavor with the crunchiness of the Brussels sprouts. And I really, really like that because I like the texture and I like the taste.
And Gigi, so, do you cook them yourself?
I do most of the cooking, and my mom helps me.
Well, you sound like a chef in the making. You seem to have a really good palate since you're bringing in that acidity and you like texture with the crunch. So bravo.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gigi. Well, actually, Gigi brought up a great point because one of my favorite cookbooks I was telling Rob earlier is called The Cook-Along Book, and I got it when I was probably about Gigi's age, and it shows there are many, many stains, and some of the pages are stuck together, and they're very basic but really good recipes, and I still go back to do the beef stew recipe. They actually have a recipe for making your own pancake mix, which I've kind of fancied up and I actually use to give as gifts. And it's a great cookbook, and it actually makes me laugh every time I use it because in the middle of a recipe, all of a sudden in all caps, it'll say, be careful with that knife, or make sure you ask for help with that hot pot, or have you washed your hands recently? But it's a kid's cookbook, but it's a really great go-to basic cookbook.
I love that story, and it's just it's such a feeling of empowerment for kids to have some control over the menu and the recipes you're choosing, not to mention helping with the cooking.
And Anna, before we go back to our callers, I want to ask you to name some names here. What are a couple of your favorite cookbooks to sit down and read, for one, with that coffee or cocktail, depending on the time of day, and your favorite ones to cook with?
Oh, well, my cookbook is a little... excuse me, my collection is a little embarrassing. I have into the hundreds of cookbooks, and I love them. So I always get the new ones because they come out in spring and fall. And for new ones this year, the one that I wrote about in my column last week is a cookbook called Near and Far by Heidi Swanson. And Heidi Swanson is a blogger out of San Francisco, and her blog is called 101 Cookbooks, and she has beautiful photography, and she's vegetarian. And her recipes are very simple and well-written, but they have such surprising combinations, things that you'd think, why didn't I think of this before? But you really never did think of it before. And the recipe I featured in my column is called a dried fruit salad, and it has dates and apricots and parsley and olive oil and lemon and salt. And it's just something I never would have put together, but it's delicious.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jennifer in Columbus joins us. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi.
I have, my favorite cookbooks to use are the ones from the Church Cookbooks or Kiwanis Club or Lions Club. You know, something where you have many contributors, but they're the ordinary people contributors. I love them because the people don't contribute a recipe unless it is their favorite and it is a no-fail recipe.
I love those too, Jennifer, and I love just the whole history behind just the Junior League cookbook mentioned before, and the Church cookbooks, and the Company cookbooks. There's such history and so much realness there, and they're a lot of fun to read. And I like to go find my grandmother's and my parents' old ones and find there's a lot of fun recipes and history there.
Yeah, on the Central Time Facebook page, we've got links to a couple of archives, one here at UW, one I think at Michigan State it was, with a lot of older cookbooks. I was thumbing through them online, and they've got, you know, some that are typewritten, some that are handwritten recipes, some of Bucky Badger's favorite foods, I think circa 1955 among them. That tells us a story not just about food, but about the people who contribute those recipes, don't they, Anna?
It does, through the way the recipes are written, the actual design and layout of the books, through the ingredients. You can really see it's really a reflection or a snapshot of that time and age. It's really fascinating.
And so you said you have a couple hundred cookbooks. How, you know, I'm guessing there are some that are in a more frequent rotation, but, you know, how do you use them? Or are they partly just friends you have sitting near you?
Structural support, load-bearing cookbooks.
You know, I don't own stock in this company, but last year I discovered a website called eatyourbooks.com. And basically what they've done is they've indexed cookbooks. And so if you buy a subscription, and I believe it's $35 a year, you can input all the titles of your collection, and then it becomes a searchable database of all the recipes that you have in your cookbook. So I can type in roasted chicken, and it will give me a list of all the roasted chicken recipes in my cookbooks. And the recipe isn't in there. You still have to physically go get the book and look it up, but it'll tell you which book there's a recipe in and the basic ingredients in that book, so you can see if it's one when you want to dive into. So I can say that has vastly increased the use of my cookbooks.
I think a lot of people just perked up their ears at this concept. What's the name of that again?
It's eatyourbooks.com.
Eatyourbooks.com.
It's, somebody's ears perked up here, Judith.
Yeah.
I usually don't shill for things, but it is fantastic and really helps me get kind of my money's worth from my cookbooks. And the other thing I like to do, and this my husband laughs at me, is I will kind of set a goal that I'm going to either cook from a new book every day for a week, or I'll take one book and cook from that for the week and just kind of make that my go-to and just dive into it and really explore it. And also when I first get books, I go through it immediately and I sticky note stuff that catches my eye so I can pick something up a couple months later and know that there's five or six recipes that I was already interested in.
We're talking about what makes a great cookbook and why they can be so much fun to look through, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you have a go-to cookbook that you couldn't cook without? What is it? What makes it so good? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find some interesting reference material on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with food writer Anna Thomas Bates about what makes a cookbook great, and we'd like to hear from you.
What is your favorite cookbook? How did you find it? Do you have a lot of cookbooks, like Anna? Or do you have just a couple that you use a lot all the time? Call 800-642-123 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers with John in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I would like to say that Anna sounds a lot like my wife. My wife is always buried in the cooking book. in the evening. And our favorite cookbook right now, at least, is Julia Child's The Way to Cook. And that's just a classic, but we love it because it has, like, one technique for whitefish and then ways to tweak it. So it really just shows you, you know, the full technique of what you're doing and then gives you lots of ideas to play on for that.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Julia Child, a classic there. Anna, how many of hers are in your collection?
Oh, I have quite a few. She's amazing. And her, and also kind of a good friend of hers who's still around today, is Dori Greenspan. And they both write recipes in a similar way. They give you lots of information on technique, but you can tell that they want you to really learn it and then make that recipe your own. I feel like nothing would make them happier than to know you made their recipe so many times and made enough tweaks that you may have even forgotten where it originally came from.
And actually, her partner in crime on PBS, Jacques Pepin, has a brand new cookbook out just this fall called, I believe, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen.
Yes, he does, and I love him as well.
We'll go back to our callers. Abigail is on the line in Brooklyn. Abigail, hi.
Hi. One of my favorite cookbooks, and I like to give it as gifts often, is The New Vegetarian Epicure by Anna Thomas, and that's one that I've read cover to cover many times because she recreates all of her, it's by menu, and she recreates each menu and describes what it meant to her, and it's really fun to read, and all the recipes are great. Not just for vegetarians either, of course.
And did this help get you into cooking, Abigail?
Yes, I checked it out from the library when I was 15, and I read it in one night, and I've been cooking ever since. I actually was a professional cook for 5 years when I was old enough.
Abigail, thank you so much. Great story. And the library reminds me, Anna, that that's how I've done a lot of my cookbook finding. I'll check it out from the library and, you know, I'll get maybe an Indian cookbook and learn how to do a couple basic things. Then I've got that in my repertoire and that's probably all I'll take out of it. But that's a great way to try out those cookbooks.
It is. And a lot of times if there's a cookbook not there, a lot of libraries are looking for suggestions as well as to what you might like to see them order. But it's a good way to preview a book or just give it a try.
And Anna, should we say that you, Anna Thomas Bates, are not Anna Thomas of the New Vegetarian Epicure?
That is true. Anna Thomas is a great vegetarian author. And I think she wrote one called Love Soup not too long ago that is a favorite of mine that has some beautiful recipes in it. And it's a good point, just bringing her up. And Deborah Madison is another cook who cooks primarily vegetarian, but that shouldn't stop other people from getting the books. Those two are so talented that, you know, Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone by Deborah Madison is probably one of my most often used cookbooks because it really has a great way to cook everything from waffles to soups, and it goes through almost every vegetable you can think of and a few great ways to prepare them.
Let's go back to the phones, and Russ joins us from Monroe. Hi, Russ.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The book that I use often isn't so much a cookbook. It's called Culinary Artistry, and I think one of the authors was Doran or something. But what it is a compilation of everything that goes with everything else and the basic ingredients in many different cuisines. So if you could look up chicken, it would tell you the things that, you know, go with chicken, which would be an awful lot. But there's very specific things that these are things that go well. These are spices that go well. These are other vegetables that pair well. And it also it defines different cuisines where you can go and say Taiwanese, you know, is mostly, you know, garlic, ginger, and scallions. So I use it as like a way to, if I'm creating something, I can go, okay, or let's say I have a piece of fish. I can go in and say, well, what goes great with this piece of fish? And it'll list all these different things, and some you never think of.
I'm glad you brought that one up. It's actually by Karen Page and her husband, Andrew Dornenberg, and they wrote Culinary Artistry, and they also wrote the Flavor Bible and the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, and it's like your next-level cookbook. And just like the caller said, you can look up almost any ingredient and find all the flavors that complement it, and it's a great resource. A lot of bartenders, a lot of chefs have all of these on their shelves, and they use these to kind of create new recipes, tweak recipes. You know, you can look up something like, you know, pheasant or cinnamon and just see what are all the great things that go with those things. And it's a really handy tool if you're ready to start cooking kind of without a book or a recipe.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Anna Thomas-Bates about cookbooks, what makes a good cookbook, and we're hearing your favorites at 800-642-1234. Barbara's with us next in Waupaca. Barbara, hi.
Hello. The book that I like very much is a book that I found in a used bookstore, and the title of it is Candy Hits by Sizzou Pitts. Hello?
Candy Hits. Okay, thank you. So it's a candy-making cookbook, Anna. Do you have any good, that's a specialized one, do you have any favorite candy-type cookbooks?
You know, I don't think I have any that are specifically candy. I have a ton of dessert and cookies and cakes and kind of general desserts, but nothing just for candy. And I couldn't quite hear the caller as to what the title was.
Candy Hits, H-I-T-S. So these are ones that are surefire hits, I guess. Candy Hits.
That sounds like one to look up.
We had a caller, John, in Madison, who said he's learning about vegan cooking using Angela Liddon's Oh, She Glows cookbook. He says there are excellent soups, stews, and desserts, and you wouldn't even think they were vegan.
Yeah, there's for all the different ways people are eating today, there are lots and lots of cookbooks to help them achieve their goals. There's lots of vegan cookbooks out right now. Last year was a huge year for vegan cookbooks. There's a lot of paleo cookbooks coming out this year, a lot of gluten-free. So if you're interested in experimenting with some of those recipes, there's some very talented authors who can kind of get you going down the right path. And even if you're not eating that way, I think it's a nice way to shake things up a little bit, try something new, and, you know, just mix it into your repertoire once or twice a week even.
Well, that's a great use for a cookbook when you're kind of exploring uncharted territory, whether it's a new dietary restriction or lifestyle choice or a new ethnic style of cooking. And I used to try this. I tried to recreate, you know, Indian, I'll say again, restaurant food at home without recipes. It was horrible. So
yeah.
that cookbook is a way to get in there and start figuring out the basics.
Yeah, and especially for things like the Asian and the Indian and Moroccan, there's spice combinations and different spices that you might not have thought about. And with our incredible grocery stores these days and the spice stores, you can get your hands on a lot of those specialty ingredients, and then you can really do some amazing recreations at home.
So
it's a great way to travel abroad without taking a plane.
So, Anna, there are a lot of food-focused holidays on the horizon. Are there some cookbooks that you really like for maybe new twists on old favorites or dishes that are going to please a crowd?
Sure. For kind of classic holiday stuff, I actually go back a lot to my old magazine recipes, which aren't cookbooks, but from Bon Appetit and Food and Wine. They just have some really amazing classic holiday recipes. And if you're looking for something trendy, then a lot of the newer food sites who have put out cookbooks like Food 52 are great ways to get those classics with maybe a little bit of a twist or a different technique. And then if you're really looking, especially if this is like your first Thanksgiving dinner, America's Test Kitchen is a great way to get all those sides and all those classics done easy as possible with kind of no-fail recipes.
Anna, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section. You can keep sharing your favorite cookbooks at the Central Time Facebook page.